Well, maybe I should stand over here just so you can hear a little better. We welcome you to this presentation this afternoon. It's, of course, no surprise to you that it's mighty good for us to have Angelo back for a brief stay and have his friend Anna along, too. And on Friday, to give a presentation at the high school, and are going to sort of follow the same format probably and give you some idea of the work that they've been in. And just appreciate the interest that you've shown, the prayers you've offered on Angelo's behalf and our behalf as well. It's Africa seems like a long way away, especially where he has been working. But we're just grateful for your support and for your prayers. You know, I would say this: if you'd like to move up on this side, you'd be quite a bit closer to the. Just come on up on the on this other side. We just didn't quite plan as well as we might have here. If you sit pretty close to the center, you'll still get most of the bang. So. Well, I think before we begin, we'll just pause for a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, you are a gracious God, you are a great God, and we thank you for how you provide for your children the world over. And this afternoon, we're again just very quite aware that there's a tremendous disparity among even your children in how that our needs, our physical needs are met. And we just want to be faithful in sharing with others the best that we know how. Father, we do pray your blessing on the presentation this afternoon, that you could be honored, and we just pray your blessing on Angelo and Anna as they share. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Just turn the time over to Angelo, and I'm assuming at the end, if he doesn't want to field some questions, I can at least field them and tell him and direct them to him. So,
well, good afternoon. It's nice to see everyone out this afternoon. It's always kind of humbling to come back and after having been gone for actually quite a number of years, just in and out of the community at different times, but. I always feel very welcomed when I come back, and I really do appreciate the interest that that you take in my life and in the life of my family that still lives here. So I guess I want to start out with a thank you for that. Yeah, this afternoon I heard that a few people wanted to hear about the work that I've been doing and am doing over in Sudan, so I'll be just kind of going over some of that. Maybe, I can talk to people one-on-one, but this is a format where I can tell a bunch of people at once. I'll open it up for questions at the end if I remember, and if I don't, I told my mom to remind me. And so I'll give sort of the brief skeleton, and then if there's anything you want more details on, you can ask at that time. Ever since July of last year, I've been working for Samaritan's Purse, which is an NGO. An NGO is a non-governmental organization, sort of shorthand that we use. Often NGOs are relief agencies, and that is what Samaritan's Purse is, a relief agency. We're based in Boone, North Carolina. I think most of you would know of Samaritan's Purse because of the Operation Christmas Child program we've done actually out of this church a number of years. I don't know, has it been done recently or doesn't look like it? Okay, I see. All right. Anyhow, but that's what most people know Samaritan's Purse by. It's actually we have our fingers in a lot of other work as well. And we're spread out over quite a lot of the world. I don't even know all the countries that we're working in right now. But we are working in Sudan, obviously. And it's actually one of the biggest, one of our biggest programs in South Sudan. A few facts about Sudan. Let me remove this. Actually, let me zoom out just a bit so you can get a context for where it is in Africa. All right, there we go. I thought I was experiencing vertigo there for a little bit. Sudan is surrounded by, what is it, about five other countries. Egypt North, Libya, Chad, Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda right here, Kenya, Ethiopia, Eritrea. It has a small port on the Red Sea. But it's a very large country. It's actually, I understand it's about a third of the size of the United States, so that gives you a bit of an idea of how big it is. Darfur, which is in the news a lot these days, this kind of western area over here, it's about the size of France. So it's not a small place. I'll zoom in a bit more so I can indicate where I've been. Actually, I'll leave that for now. Let me go back to talking about some general statistics. There's Sudan is a country of roughly 40 million people, and it's actually divided into two sort of sections, in northern Sudan and southern Sudan, which I'll explain that a bit more shortly. It has to do with the war that was recently fought. But in the south, there are about 11 million people. And obviously, any census is going to be an estimate of sorts. But when I say roughly, in this case, I do mean very, very roughly. The last census that, before this year, the last census that Sudan had, I think, was taken sometime in the 1950s. And ever since then, they've had too many other things that are occupying their time and minds a lot more than counting people. So they took a census this year, which from my observation didn't look like it was terribly accurate. I'm sure there are statisticians that can maybe make an accurate number out of it, but it is a very sketchy figure as far as I'm concerned. A few other factors, just to kind of put things in perspective. 90% of Sudanese earn less than $1 a day. Child mortality, according to one source, says that 145 out of 1,000 births, the child dies. Out of 100,000 pregnancies, 2,030 women die. That's the highest maternal mortality in the world, actually. Since the war, another statistic, I know that you've probably heard some about the phenomenon of child soldiers in places like Uganda and Liberia and Sierra Leone. It also has been an issue in Sudan. And since 2001, 20,000 children have been demobilized out of the military. And I'm sure, you know, the child, deciding who counts as a child is probably up to some debate, but I'm assuming this was anyone 17 and younger fighting in the military. Sudan has been, or was up until 2005, in a state of civil war. Ever since 1962, they had a relatively brief break from 1972 to 1983 when there was a peace. But apart from that, reprieve, ever since 1962, there's been fighting going on somewhere in Sudan. The factors of the war, obviously every war is caused by a bunch of different factors, and it's kind of hard to pin down exactly what all causes it. But one writer put it this way, in a very brief and easy way of thinking about it. It was basically because of the three R's that usually cause wars: riches, race, and religion. South Sudan has oil that the North would like to have. Some of it is the places where there is oil, the South, obviously they probably want it for the oil revenues, but it's also their land, or they consider it their land. And so obviously they don't want to let it go to the North. Racially, there's often northern Sudanese are viewed as Arabs, and in the South they're Black African. Although obviously there's been a lot of mixing throughout the years. And then also the religion thing in the North, it's pretty heavily Islamic, while in the South it's either animist and pagan or Christian of some sort. So it's viewed as a clash along a lot of different lines. And something else that really complicates things is that Sudan, in the South especially, is also very tribal. And so even within, like, the southern fighters, you had different tribes. You have Nuer, Dinka, and different tribes trying to sort of gain supremacy within the rebel groups. And in terms of what the war did, one of the first things that they say that they estimate about 2 million people lost their lives during the course of all these wars. 4 million people have been displaced from their homes. It basically, you know, along with all the death, it really did halt Sudan's development. It is in a lot of ways still a very backwards country. It just hasn't had time to develop any kind of an infrastructure, which is a huge problem. One example, the roads. I think the first roads that I ever saw in Sudan, the first paved roads that I ever saw in Sudan were when I went to Juba, probably about 6 months after I got there. That was, I found a stretch of nice paved asphalt road. Most of the road is just a murum or a dirt that is a mess in the rainy season. Now that the war is over, NGOs like Samaritan's Purse have decided that it is a very important and a key place to bring their resources. And actually, Samaritan's Purse was in South Sudan ever since 1997, so they were there even during the war. But since the war, obviously, working is a lot easier. So I know quite a few NGOs, almost all the major NGOs, are working in Sudan at this point. Maybe I'll turn a little bit now to my work. So I went to Sudan, like I said, last July. I went first to Yei, which is way down here, almost in Uganda. In a lot of ways, I'd say it looks like Uganda, or how I would imagine Uganda to look. It's a fairly temperate area, gets a good amount of rain. It's not the desert that you usually think of when you think of Sudan. So I worked in Yei for about a year. And while I was there, I was working in what Samaritan's Purse calls the Church Reconstruction Program. There were hundreds of churches that were destroyed during the war for a number of different reasons. They were destroyed by both northern forces and southern forces. It wasn't always clear if it was out of spite, towards the Christians, or if it was just sometimes the SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, or the Rebel Army of the South, would take refuge in churches. And so, of course, government forces would feel obliged to attack the churches. But for whatever reason, there were hundreds of churches that were destroyed. And so SP has been working to rebuild churches that were destroyed during that war. So I went. I started first as a community mobilizer. I'd go out and work with the churches because basically the program is, we try to view it as much as possible as a partnership between Samaritan's Purse and the local church. So part of that involves the church contributing, investing some sweat equity in the building. And so we'd ask them to gather the sand, the gravel, just the different materials, as well as making blocks for the structure. So once all the materials were gathered and the blocks were made, then we were able to bring in professional crews, most of them being Ugandans, actually, that we hired, just because there just isn't much skilled labor at all in Sudan. But we'd bring in crews then to actually put up the structures after the church had put in all the work of gathering the materials. And I was very impressed in working with the local community as to how eager they were to rebuild their churches and to really put forth a good effort. They really did work hard. It was certainly not a handout from SP to the community. They certainly invested in it as well. So I worked in mobilization for a few months. I would say my first year was marked by, if anything I could describe it as, it would have been transition. Like the whole year was, I felt like I was constantly learning a new job. After mobilization, I went into procurement. We brought up a lot of our raw materials from Uganda. You can't actually see it. Somewhere down here is Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. So we bring in a lot of our, especially the steel, just because you can't buy it in Sudan. Not good quality stuff for a reasonable price. So procurement was involved a lot more. I actually stayed on the compound a lot. It involved a lot of phone work and just inventory tracking and that sort of thing, which it was a good experience, but I was glad to move out of it when I finally had the chance. It was fairly stressful as well because we were building churches at a really rapid pace. I understand in the deep south, basically this area right here, we just recently completed our 100th church. So and that's been, I think we first moved in 2005. So they've been moving at a pretty steady rate, pretty fast pace. So that was a bit more stressful in that way, making sure that we always had the materials that we needed to keep going. And then after I worked in procurement for a few months, then I moved into a position where I was basically managing the compound. My title was base manager, and it got changed to program manager eventually. But that meant working a lot more with people again, which I thought was great. It could be a whole range of things, whether it was working with our national staff there on the compound, HR issues, solving disputes, working with the local government, just any number of things. It was a good time as well. It was stressful, but I felt like I learned a lot and I grew a lot. So I did enjoy my work there. And I was in Yay through June of this year, and in the very early part of July, I moved up to Kurmuk, which is right here. Kurmuk is in southern Blue Nile State. Blue Nile State is technically in the north. I should have mentioned, I guess. the south is divided up into 10 states, and then there's the north, which I'm not sure how many states are there, but the south is roughly runs from here down. And I'm working in Blue Nile State, which is technically in the north, but the area that I'm actually working in is to the far south of that state and was actually occupied by the SPLA, the Southern Forces, and that area is generally considered loyal to the south. Either way, there's just to backtrack a bit. Since the CPA was signed, there's this interim peace, and there's a government that's been established in the south, which is still somewhat accountable to the north. The president of the south is the first vice president of all of Sudan, and so they're trying to run sort of a two government system right now, which is in some ways still with the south still being somewhat accountable to Khartoum. In 2011, then they're planning on a referendum in which a vote will be taken to decide whether or not the South secedes and becomes its own country or if it stays with the North. The tricky thing is in places like Blue Nile State, where I am, it's a transitional area, and either way, it's in the North. If the South votes to stay with the North in 2011, it shouldn't be a big issue, I don't think. But if the South votes to secede and become its own country, in a place like Blue Nile State, it will become quite a lot more tricky because the Southerners or the people there consider themselves to be Southerners and are loyal to the SPLA and to the Juba government. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that all pans out. You never know quite what to expect in Sudan, and it is a source of concern. I know a lot of people talk about fully expecting the war to start up again, and you hear a lot of rumors like that, and you know, after a while you start wondering if it's just a lot of talk and bluster. I really don't know, honestly. Because the tricky thing about Sudan is that situations change so fast. Anyhow, back to Kurmuk. So I moved there in July. We're running a few programs there. We don't actually do the church reconstruction program at all up there right now, primarily because there really weren't any, or very few churches were destroyed there during the war because there weren't many churches. It's a heavily Islamic area, actually. There is one church about 90 miles south of Kurmuk that was destroyed, that there's a chance that we may go in and rebuild it at some point. But it's the CRP, the reconstruction program, is not very big where I am. Our major project is a hospital. I'll show you a few pictures later. It's about 100 beds, and it serves pretty much all of southern Blue Nile State. It's kind of hard to read up here, but my understanding is that we get patients from generally this area up here. They really travel some very long distances sometimes. Donovan is sort of the next closest area that has some kind of good medical facilities. Actually, I take that back. There is another town further south, but Kurmuk does catch a lot of the patients in southern Blue Nile State. So the hospital is really our biggest program. We're also running a community center right now, which is essentially a primary school. We do some girls' programs out of there as well. The women of Sudan have been very, very much marginalized. And so we run some month-long girls' programs, but the main activity is a primary school, a grade school. We just started our second term of the year in July, and I understand they registered over 700 students. And those can be anyone from, you know, small children wanting to learn to read to 50 and 60-year-olds wanting to learn to read. They just never had a chance. So it's an interesting project. And then sort of our third main activity right now is some agriculture programs that we're running at a model farm south of Kurmuk, about 20 miles down a bad road. And that program is in quite a bit of flux right now. We're trying to figure out where it's going to go next, because some good things are happening there, but it's in a place that's really inaccessible a lot of the year because of the rains. So that's sort of a rundown of the things I've been doing. I'm going to actually have Anna get up and talk a bit about what she did while she was in Sudan, and then we'll sort of tag team here. I'll then follow that by talking a bit about some of the challenges that I faced, and I think she'll do the same. And then we'll have a few slides after that, and then questions. So I'll turn the time over to Anna.
Hi. I'm not used to hearing my voice overhead. So I actually met Angelo because there was a rumor of cholera, in the area that he was working in, southern Sudan and around the Yei area. And so the NGO I was working with, we went down to investigate. And that's kind of how we worked. I worked with an NGO that is a European Swiss-based NGO called MedAir. It was started by doctors and pilots. And it has kind of morphed into an NGO that works with water and sanitation. We work with health, and then we do capacity building and health promotion as well. So it's a smaller NGO than Samaritan's Purse, and it's a bit more focused in its structure and what it does. I'm a nurse by training, and I worked with our health program there. Within South Sudan, we have two programs. We have a static site, which is our permanent primary health care center, and I worked up there for a short bit, and then I was on the emergency response team that we flew to all the 10 states within South Sudan to respond to rumored outbreaks of things. And when I say rumored outbreaks, we talk about rumors or we talk about rough numbers or things like that. Rumored outbreaks is anything from somebody in a remote village saying that somebody has died. So then they're going to walk 4 hours to the next village that maybe is a bit bigger, and maybe they have a radio or somebody from there is going to the next village, and things get communicated that way. Usually in a big town, there might be a radio, and so somebody will radio into a larger town, maybe Juba, or they might have a connection with an NGO. And so rumors actually get out that way. So that's how we would hear from some remote village somewhere we've never heard of, that something was going on. And so we try and get as much information as possible. We'd charter a plane. A few of us would get some information about what we were hopefully going to be doing and seeing, and we'd fly out there. Sometimes we'd fly out there and we couldn't land because it turned out the airstrip's not landable. And so we'd fly back. Things are rough. They're a bit sketchy. But that was the team I was on, was the emergency response team. So when I met Angelo, it's because we were responding to cholera that was down there. Our other health program is our static site, our permanent site. And when Angelo talked about Sudan, it's starting to kind of come together and form an infrastructure. But it's still in a very beginning process. So for the primary health care, 3 out of 10 people have access to primary health care in South Sudan. And primary health care means that if you had access, you would be able to go to hopefully a clinic, which would probably be anything from a mud hut to a building that maybe an NGO had built. There might or there might not be actual medicine there because maybe it hasn't been supplied. The government's supposed to be taking over some of that responsibility and supplying some of the medicine, and so things are getting kind of worked out that way. So sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. There's no running water, there's no electricity. And the person who's going to be greeting you, as well as treating and diagnosing you, is somebody who has received medical training for 9 months only. So that's primary health care. Our permanent site that we run is in Upper Nile, which is kind of closer to where Angelo is now. I was up here. That's where our primary health care center is. MedAir is up there because it's also kind of a disputed area. One of the things I liked about MedAir is that in their mandate, they like to go to places that are forgotten people or areas nobody else wants to go. So Upper Nile State is somewhere a lot of people don't want to go. We're the only health NGO there, and we're the only NGO that's up there in the town that we're in right now. We have the UN across the street. The UN military's there, and the UN peacekeepers are in town. Because there's a big oil pumping station right next to us. And so we had the rebel forces camped on one side of us, and we had the North Army on the other side of us. So there were lots of soldiers, lots of guns. It's kind of an interesting area, but that's also kind of why I like Medairs, because they go to those places. But we were setting up a healthcare center, which is kind of a step up from a clinic, that we helped train and support some medical assistants who've received a lengthier medical training, and they run a clinic, and we also do, so we do obstetrics there. We don't do any surgeries, but we have inpatient services and outpatient, and we have a little lab and things like that, and we ran a nutrition center up there that I worked at for a while, which is really fun. And I'm not too familiar with all the water and sanitation stuff, but if you talk about South Sudan, latrines are a big issue. Nobody has them. And really, towns don't have them. And so that's something that a lot of education and behavior change is trying to get started and be done. And things are moving along, which is really a positive thing. It'll help decrease disease outbreaks and things. So that's sanitation-wise. They'll often go in and do education and try and explain why latrines are helpful and necessary and people should use them and build them. And water, a lot of people go to just standing water. If there's a river nearby, they'll use the river. There are boreholes or wells, but there's, I don't know of a figure, but there are not enough for as many people that need clean water. It's often you would hear, like where we went when we were investigating the cholera outbreak, there are wells out there, but either they're broken or people don't go to them for some reason or another. So the one that they will go to, or they try to go to if possible, is about like a 5 to 7 mile walk. And in Sudan, it's quite hot. So you don't usually do a lot of movement during the afternoon. Mornings are pretty busy. Evenings are pretty busy. People don't move around much after dark. But the daytime, it's easily in the 100-degree temperature. And so people don't move around much. So access to clean water is really an issue. So people will go to standing pools, or they'll go to rivers or creeks or whatever they can find, and they'll collect water there. So Medair also goes in, and we have a drilling team that we would drill boreholes for communities. But we had also set up emergency water systems for places that have flooded, or places like around Yay, where Angela was working. There's a few of them there because the population's increasing so much, and we would pump water from the river, treat it, and then provide it for the community there in hopes that they would use it and not have cholera issues like they were having. So that's a little bit of what I was doing and what Medair is about and who I was working for.
Thank you, Anna. Anna lived a life of more adventure and excitement than I did, actually. She traveled a lot more, and her stories generally tend to be far more interesting than mine. I think I'll go now to just talking a bit about some of the challenges and the aspects of life in Sudan that make life interesting there. Sudan is really, in a lot of ways, it's a broken country. If you know, most unfortunate and sad things that happen to people, you list them, they probably happened or are happening in Sudan. It can be a little bit overwhelming sometimes, and I think probably for me the biggest challenge that I face is just sort of coming to grips with the ugliness and the sadness that you see there. Regularly, repeatedly. Death is much more just sort of a matter-of-fact thing. It happens to people, and it happens to young people a lot more than it happens to young people here. Things that just don't make sense, they seem really unfair. I told a story the other day. I had one of our compound manager. He's a Sudanese national compound manager in Yay. one of my favorite people there and one of our best employees. His wife was pregnant. She's going to be having a baby. I'm not quite sure how soon she was due, but I think it was in the next month or two, I believe. But she got sick with typhoid and malaria. They took her to the local hospital, which is, you know, by no means something that I would want to take my wife to. You know, it's not not a very pretty place at all. But he left her there because he thought she was going to be fine. They were treating her and stuff, and he came back to work. He gets a phone call a few hours later. It turns out that without authorization or anything, the doctors had determined that it would be okay to cut the mother open and remove the baby sort of inexplicably. So, of course, the baby ended up dying. And his wife did recover, but it was just something that seemed really sort of random and unfair. You know, seeing something like that happen and sort of observing how they react to that, then, you know, they have a time of mourning and then they move on. It's like, well, that's the way life goes. You know, that's something that was and is kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around. You know, it raises questions. I think they're good things to think about, but, you know, you have to think again about the goodness of God and what all this means and my view of God. So it's a challenge. It's good, but it is challenging. Probably the next thing, the infrastructure in Sudan is, like I said, atrocious. I mentioned the roads. They really, really are bad. Like along with the little paved road in Juba, I know there's one stretch of road up somewhere around Wau. But other than that, it's all dirt or clay road that turns into a I guess morass might be the right word in the wet season. I can go on and on about the way the roads have hampered or slowed down my life or made my life difficult. We had one situation. We were trying to bring cement out from Uganda, and the rains had been particularly heavy. And during the dry season of the trip, if it's a reasonably good trip, should take 2 or 3 days. But this was a cement truck that left Kampala and finally pulled into our compound about 3 months later. He got stuck repeatedly. His truck kept breaking down. He was robbed. It was unbelievable. What I found the most impressive, though, was, you know, he pulls into our compound having been beaten up, down, and sideways by life. But he's a Somali driver, and Somalians are quite resilient, I think. He pulled in and acted like there was just no big deal. This was the way life goes, and he was okay with it. 3 months, you know, he's sitting by the side of the road. He could be sitting in Kampala. It didn't really make any difference. He seemed pretty happy. So that impressed me, and I think there's a lesson there for us somewhere. Government and just in general, yeah, government and officials, working with officials in general, is still a bit of a frustration. They're still learning what it means to govern fairly and justly and efficiently, without corruption. This happened before I arrived, actually, in Ye, a few months before I came. There was a situation where a number of our staff, along with a few staff from another organization, had decided to climb a mountain nearby. It was, you know, especially being a Kansas boy, I can totally identify with the urge. You see a hill somewhere, it makes sense to go climb it just to see what you can see from the top. And so they made a Sunday afternoon of hiking this mountain. And when they came back down, they were greeted by some police who, my understanding was that the charge was they had been stealing mercury from the top of the mountain. which was completely far-fetched. It made a little more sense later when I found out that maybe at some point they had put some sort of a seismic reader or seismic sensor of some sort up there that might have had some mercury in it. So it was perhaps not completely ungrounded, but it still made completely no sense to our staff and seemed really irrational. And what followed was really irrational. They took some of our staff, the white staff, because they thought they would be protected by the UN or something. They kept their hands off the white staff pretty much. But a number of our Ugandans, two of them, were really seriously beaten, and they had guns held to their heads and were told to confess, and if not, they'd be shot and things like that. And it was extremely traumatic. I think a lot of it stemmed from, relatively uneducated people, uneducated policemen. It was a chance at exercising some power. And they, again, they're still learning what it means to govern fairly and justly. I think just another sort of example of the toll that war can take, especially after years and years of it. It hinders everything, including education, and I think ignorance is really probably one of the biggest problems, in terms of progress. People just not understanding how life can and should be. A few other things. I learned pretty quickly that if I was there to get thanks, then to get thanks for the work that I was doing, then it was just as well that I go home, because there was a fair amount of gratitude, but there was also a fair amount of gratitude along with requests for further assistance. Often at our, it's certainly not unheard of at like a church that we opened. At some point during the service, they would say, "Well, thank you for this building. Now it would be great if you would tear out that back wall and extend it a little bit further, make it a little bit bigger. Or it would be great if you would bring in a school or a clinic or something else." All not unreasonable requests, but we can all only do so much. That was something that I had to get used to, but I've become okay with it, and it's not really what I'm there for anyhow. The thanks, I don't expect to receive a lot of thanks for what I do there. I find it fulfilling and energizing anyhow. There's a real lack of capacity in the population. Just a lot of teaching needs to be done. Again, the war took its toll, and nobody was able to learn anything that could help them to improve their own lives or get jobs or what have you. Deal some with loneliness. You're around other people, but it still does feel pretty remote sometimes. So certainly loneliness was a challenge. Security, where I've been so far, security hasn't been a real big issue. We've had a few times when things got a bit tense. Probably our biggest problem was when the Lord's Resistance Army, which is a rebel army from Uganda, started moving around some. They do sort of their typical MO is to go into villages and pillage the towns, raping and stealing and robbing. They can get really quite ugly. It can be quite random as to how they decide to attack. So if they're on the move somewhere, the UN sends out warnings not to travel this road because of a suspected movement at some point. But they were moving basically up around this area. They did travel up into Central African Republic as well, but this is kind of their main area of movement, and so Ye is right in that area. Their main hideout right now is in Garamba National Park, which is over here in Congo. But in Ye, we were really perfectly safe. It was just a question of, working out in some of the outlying areas when we should when we should go out with trucks and when we shouldn't. And those decisions are always a bit tricky to make, and just the challenge of having to be the one sometimes who decided whether or not we send somebody out, and that responsibility was did weigh a bit heavy on me at times. So those are some of the sort of, I guess, difficulties that I've seen while I've been over there. But I guess I talk about these too because this is part of the reason I really enjoy working in Sudan, and I find it a unique experience. It's for somehow for me, I do get kind of an enjoyment out of waking up in the morning and not being quite sure what's going to break that day. And, you know, when nothing happens, it's, you know, it's good, but it's a little bit boring. I have enjoyed it. I don't consider myself really much of a risk taker, but it is a way of life that I've kind of come to enjoy a bit. And I guess along with that, I would say the things that I deal with, you know, I can go to Sudan, I can work there for a year or two, but my Sudanese friends, like, that's what they grew up with, and that's all that they know. And seeing the way that they attack these problems and handle this stuff has been a real challenge. Like I said, they've become matter of fact in a way about death, and I think in some ways that can be a bad thing. In some ways, I think it can be sort of a good thing. I think they realize better than perhaps we do that life is short, and they've learned what it means to make the most of life while they're alive. One writer in a book called The Zanzibar Chest by Aidan Hartley, he made a comment, something to the effect that he thinks, you know, despite all of, this is in referring more to Africa in general, but despite all the problems that they have there, he suspects that the happiness quotient is as high there as it is anywhere in the world. And I think he's right. I think maybe the happiness quotient is higher in Africa than it is in places that are more well developed. They know what it means to have a hard life and what it means to scramble to survive, but they also understand what it means to find joy and happiness in even some very small things sometimes. So I really have been very blessed and encouraged in working there and working with my Sudanese friends. I think I'll turn the time back over to Anna, let her speak just a bit more, maybe about some of the things that she's faced while she was over there, and then we'll have a few slides and close.
I've been trying to think of different stories and things. Some of the challenges I faced over there, it doesn't matter where you are. There's always going to be something new, something you don't expect, as much as you try and prepare. Some of the stuff that I came across was basically in dealing with healthcare. A lot of it was watching and being somewhat helpless and watching people die. Knowing that back home, when I had worked in the States before I went over, I was working in a critical care pediatric unit where we had all the tests and anything we wanted at our fingertips, and physicians who were there around the clock and more than willing to help and tell us how we could help. And when I first arrived, my first intervention over in South Sudan, it was a bunch of nurses. There were three of us at the time, and we were trying to figure out IV drip rates for patients and diagnosing and treating, and it was very different, and it was very challenging because you don't have running water. you barely have a blood pressure cuff if you can steal it back from the other guys who stole it from you, because they didn't have one either. really, your resources are taking temperature and, you know, looking at the patient and trying to figure out from their physical assessment what's going on. So that's a huge challenge, and and was hard for me emotionally. I had mentioned that I worked at the nutrition center, which I loved. It's really great. Skinny kids, not that you want them skinny, but they're so cute because they're so little and you think that they're just little babies, but they're really like a year old or a year and a half old. So they've got so much personality that they are so fun. Once you get them well and they're interactive and like wanting to play and aren't scared and sick, they are so cute. So they're really fun. And then nutrition center is fun because they come every day and they come and stay all day, hopefully, so we can give them their milk every 3 hours. And there's a big rigmarole. But you get to actually have a relationship with the moms and with the kids, and they get to know you. And that's really fun. But one of the challenges was that I was their medical person, and I'm a nurse. I went to school and I learned a lot, but I didn't learn that much. And so I was treating and diagnosing people with typhoid and, I mean, all kinds of stuff, through an interpreter mostly, through a lot of pantomiming. It was very different. And then if you got a sick kid in and you were up all night with them, with the parents, and you were trying to figure out things and diagnose things, and then often it had gone so far that with our resources, there was no way that we could help them. And so you tried your best and you tried to do a cross-cultural, like, feel with the parents and with the mom usually who was there to console and try and prepare her for what was to come. And often they were much more prepared than we were, because it is much more common. One of the images that will forever be in my head is I had a little girl, Sosan, and she was about a year and a half. They had taken her to treatment several other places before they brought her to us, because there is that kind of unknown about bringing your child to foreigners. So they'll much rather try like tribal medicine and things like that first. So by the time Sosan came to us, she was a little bit beyond repair. But we did the best that we could. But it turned out one evening, she was improving for a while, and then in the 3 hours in between her feeds, one day she went downhill very quickly. And the mom knew it. And she tried to say, can I take her home? Because they came from an area that was, if I remember correctly, it was at least a 4-hour walk. So it was quite far for her to go, and she didn't have any other family there. And in Sudanese culture, wherever you die, you're buried. But if you're not from that community, you're buried in the outsider's cemetery, which in the town I was living was also the dump. So it's not a very dignified place. And we tried to keep Sosan because we thought, us being the medical people that we are, please just let us try, let us do this because you so want to help. And Sosan ended up passing away. And we offered for the mom to stay there the night, and then we would help facilitate her to get back to home the next day. And so we discussed this, and she wasn't okay with that. And then we decided, because it was dark and it wasn't safe for us to be out, so there was only so much we could offer at that point, but we offered to drive her into town, and then maybe she could arrange somehow to get back. And so as we were trying to get the car, and she wasn't too keen on that one either, but that's the best thing we could offer because she did not want to stay there. While we were trying to arrange the car, she disappeared with Sosan. And so I will forever have that image of her carrying her child who had passed as she's walking home in the dark to her family, which is several hours away. Stuff like that, it stays with you, I think. So those were some of the personal challenges I dealt with. I mean, you can talk about living in a tent for months on end, living without electricity, which for me was very rare. But I lived in a place for 5 weeks in a tent without electricity or running water or anything like that. We had a satellite phone and a radio that we did security checks with, but that was it. But then you talk about like infrastructure and dealing with the communities, because when you go in, you do have to deal with the communities to try and let them know what you're doing and be a good partner and all of that. And that is a bit frustrating at times because they don't necessarily want to do everything you want to do and all of that. And the lack of infrastructure, and there's quite a bit of corruption and a misunderstanding also of kind of what NGOs, the financial backing that NGOs have and their ability and their generosity. You go to a lot of places I went to, they think all the things that you've brought in to help with that intervention are specifically for them. And so therefore, when you leave, you should leave everything you brought with you. But for us, we weren't funded that well. There was no way we could afford to do that. We used our medical equipment and the things that we brought with us in multiple interventions. Sometimes we even flew in a car if we needed to. And that car was our car, and it went multiple places later on. But there's a lot of tense moments when communities can turn against you, and it can become quite violent. Thankfully, I was never put in that situation, but it can get very, very tight. So that's other challenges in dealing with communities and infrastructure, a lack of. One of the things that you talk about when you talk about South Sudan is that, like I said, communities can turn against you. They've been in war so long that they actually are quite quick to turn back to violence. So that's always something you kind of had to have in the back of your mind, and you had to backpedal quite quickly and be quite diplomatic about the way that you talked about things. And that was always a bit challenging too. You'd be in meetings for about 4 hours, and you just really had one thing you needed to get done, and you really just wanted to say it, but there's no way you could do that without offending 4 other people. So everybody had to have their chance to talk, and you had to talk in circles for the last 3 hours, and then you finally got done, hopefully, what you wanted to do. So some of that was always... just, it grows you in different ways, and I feel very blessed to have had all those experiences, but they can be challenging, always interesting, never a dull moment. I have a few snake stories. I think one that's preferred is the one... So I was living in a tent underneath a lovely, beautiful tree. But snakes also liked the lovely tree because it was cooler over there. And often the snakes would, you were warned when you picked up your tent that there could be things that were living under there when you were rolling it up. So to do it gingerly. Scorpions are a big issue over there too, and they tend to hide in corners and places, so it's not really the surprise you want. But one night after a long day, crawl into my little tent, which is my little home, and I just love it. But I've just gone down to laid my head down, and I could feel something slowly creeping underneath my mattress. And it was moving slow enough, and there were no legs, so I was pretty sure it was a snake and not a lizard. So I was extremely annoyed. Poisonous snakes are very common in South Sudan, but I was so tired, and this was driving me crazy because there's no way I could sleep with something slithering underneath my mattress. So me being in the state of slight incoherency, I lift up my mattress to make sure it's not under there, honestly, and it's underneath my tent. And then I just slam, 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 slam. So either I killed it, or it was going to be quiet for a while. You rolled back over, go back to sleep, quick. That was my good snake story.
It's definitely a lot tougher than I am. I'm sort of a technological moron, so I'm not sure how to make this look right, but I'll leave it as it is. Yeah, so here are a few pictures. I'll just say right before I start that they're really scattered, and there's not a lot of rhyme or reason to them. I had my camera stolen a few months ago and never really took like a nice narrative of pictures. So these are just random photos that I thought you might find interesting. This is the DC-3 that we use to fly in and out of the field. Our country office is in Nairobi, and that's where we go. They fly us out to Nairobi for our R&Rs, and obviously they take us back in then. We usually pass through Lokichogyo, which is in northwestern Kenya, and then from there go on up either into Nuba or Kormuk, where I work, or over to Yei, which is where I used to work. But yeah, it's a DC-3, I think built sometime in the 1940s or early 50s. And they retrofitted it with turboprop engines, so it goes pretty fast, but it's an interesting ride. Another plane that we use to fly around some is the Cessna Caravan. I prefer these, actually. It's not quite as old. This is a helicopter I got to fly on a few weeks ago with the UN. I had a meeting up in Damazine, which is a town north of where I'm working right now. It was some coordination meetings. So I got to fly on this thing, which I thought was pretty sweet. That's just a view taking off out of Lokichogyo. This is actually still in Kenya, but it's really quite indicative of what you'd see if flying over Sudan as well, just a lot of barren plains that are kind of desert-like in the dry season and swamp during the wet season. That's a view of the Blue Nile. The Blue Nile flows out of Ethiopia and up into Khartoum. The White Nile flows up from Uganda and into Khartoum, and then they come together there to form the Nile, which goes on up into Egypt. So this is the Blue Nile, part of the Nile. That is the airport in Yei, where I lived first. Immigration, I was telling somebody, immigration, basically, this is the first time that I arrived in Yei. And so immigration at that point consisted of getting out of the plane and hopping into that white truck there and leaving. So I think they've gotten a little more rigorous with their procedures now. But this is one of the churches that we built down in Yei. It's a very typical style. This is at the church opening. But cement blocks, steel roof. This is the workshop in Yei, and in our workshop we did a lot of the prefabrication. The steel trusses were built in the workshop, and they also built the benches, the windows and doors, pulpits, that sort of thing. Now this jumps up to Kormuk. This is where I live now in Kormuk. This is like our compound gate, the blue gates there. It's a little guard shack beside it. That is my house where I live right now, home sweet home. I heard it was just broken into actually while I was gone, so I think a few things were taken, but hopefully not too much. That's my porch there to the right, and where I live is there on the left, the dirt walls. That's our office in Kormuk. This is the hospital that SP is funding. To the right, you see a new tin roof. That's a ward that we're rebuilding. It was burned out a few months ago in a fire. That was an interesting deal too, because Kormuk is a place. There are a lot of mixed loyalties. Like in general, I would say the area is loyal to the south, but at the same time, the north is trying to get its foot in the door and exert some influence as well. But a lot of the people that live here, the locals, are really suspicious of anything from the north. Like they bring in bottled water, often a Kurmuk citizen isn't going to want to drink it because they think it might have been tainted somehow. And so when this fire happened, it coincidentally, the government from the state capital had come down to Kurmuk for a few weeks and had set up shop there. And so the first reaction of everybody there was that somehow this northern government had set the fire. There's just a lot of suspicion, and I think it was ungrounded. I think it was just an accident. It started in a laboratory. It's probably an electrical or a chemical fire of some sort. But people were very suspicious of it, and I still don't. I think a lot of people still blame it on the northern government. Another view of the ward that's being fixed up. That's another one of our wards that's functioning right now. That would be where we have the children. Not quite Hutch Hospital or Promise Regional Medical Center, whatever it's called now, but it works. This is where we do our operations. I don't actually help with the operations. But this is a shot. And this is going to a church opening. Just a little road, and that's the bridge there. The bridges in Sudan can be really hit or miss. You never quite know when you start out, as you get down the road, if the bridge that you come to is going to be in working condition or not. But this is kind of a typical one, what you'll see down there. This is a bridge that didn't work. It had broken a number of times, and it's really kind of interesting. The community will come together and fix it. You'll see the little wood post there. And they'll fix it for a while until a truck comes by that's just a little too heavy and it breaks through again. But whenever it's really quite an event whenever something breaks down on the bridge, because everything completely stops on either side. And so it's a great economic opportunity for the locals, because they can make food and bring it and sell it to the people, and a little village springs up, overnight basically. It's quite a social atmosphere. But anyhow, I'm not sure how long this truck was there. We just turned back and went home. You can see here that part of the problem was he had broken down as he was driving forward and then tried to reverse his mistake by backing up, which caused greater problems when the I-beam went up inside of his wheel well. But anyhow, it was quite interesting. And it never ceases to amaze me. They do get these things off somehow. They work until they get it going again. I always used to think that Amish ingenuity was pretty much the be-all, end-all, but I think African ingenuity is just a little bit better even. This is the truck that I was telling you about that took 3 months to come up to Yay. You'll note that there are a number of things lying at different angles than what perhaps they should be. When he pulled in, it was also funny. They usually travel with a helper who guides them when they're trying to back up. They call them turnboys. But this guy's turnboy was literally a turnboy. He was up there when he was backing around. He was up there helping to turn the steering wheel because he had no power steering apparently. So it was a two person effort. Sometimes we find water, which we are unfortunately obliged to drive through, which is always kind of fun. Sometimes it comes up too high, and then it's not as much fun anymore. But that's all right. This is me and Dr. Attar. He's a Sudanese doctor. He was educated in Khartoum and in Egypt, and he's just an unbelievable man. He was at the hospital long before Samaritan's Purse ever showed up. And he's obviously very talented as a doctor. He's got an amazing range of connections with the community as well. He's got amazing credibility. When the bombs were falling, he was running to the bomb shelters with everybody else, and he really stuck it out. And he really is, like, I have a huge amount of respect for him, and he's really the heart behind our hospital program. And it's people like him especially that makes me absolutely love working in Sudan. He's really taken what he's been given and done incredible things with it. So he's a real inspiration to me. And I guess that's it. So, yeah, are there any questions or, yeah, anything you might want to ask? I'm working on it. When I lived in Yei, it was close enough to Uganda. It's been really very anglicized, I guess is the right word. I don't know. There's a lot of English there. There were a lot of tribal languages as well. And down in that area, they speak the primary language of Sudan is Arabic. But Arabic has many different permutations. And what they spoke down in our area was Juba Arabic, which was, I think, an extremely sloppy form of Arabic mixed with, Kakwa and Bari and some of the other local languages. I'm guessing Juba Arabic is to classic Arabic, sort of like Pennsylvania Dutch is to German or something, sort of almost a slang or a dialect. the thing with Ye was that there, I didn't have to actually, like most of the time I could speak English to the people that I needed to, or I could go through an interpreter. So I was kind of spoiled. Now that I moved up into Kurmuk, which is in a much more Arabic area, I am learning more Arabic, which is good. I'm glad to have the chance. It makes things a bit more tricky sometimes, but it is good practice, and I'm glad I'm having the opportunity. So I'm certainly at a very, very basic level right now still. Yeah, Paul. Like living on our compound? Let's see, there are currently 4 Kenyans, 2 Americans, and 1 Sudanese. And then we have temporary trainers coming in, normally from Kenya as well, that live on the compound there with us. Most of our work is right there in town. Like the hospital is the main activity. But then, like I said, we have the farm, which is further south, like 20 miles or so, but it's a pretty rough 20 miles. At this point, it's more, we're SP, it focuses, it doesn't consider itself as much a mission organization as a relief organization. So right now the efforts are especially relief-oriented. I do know our country directors recently created a new position for a regional ministry coordinator who will be going around and working with those of us on the ground in the different locations to set up more specific sort of ministry-related activities. In a place like Kurmuk, it's a bit trickier because it is a very heavily Islamic area, and so the activities that you do there would need to be sensitive to that as well. But that is something that they're working on in increasing. Harold. Yeah, it's a simple question, but it's a very, very loaded question if you ask anybody over there. There have been a lot of different methods. When I was doing it, it was you look at the existing structure, you take that into account, you ask around some, ask for, estimates as to how many people attend on a normal Sunday, and usually you take what what they tell you and, you know, divide it by something. Because it's usually their figures usually count for, you know, Easter and Christmas, and not so much a regular Sunday service. So it is tricky, and then we do try to allow for a bit of growth at least in the number of people. But the truth is, like, you know, they almost invariably the church is smaller than they would like. It's been a tricky one because, you know, you don't, at some level you need to pay attention to that and respect it, because they're also partnering, they're putting in the work as well. At the same time, you can't go overboard or you're suddenly spending a lot of resources on something that, yeah, you may end up wasting more than you were hoping to. Yes, Ferry. Well, we work primarily with the Episcopal Church of Sudan. And I think those would have been mostly Anglican missionaries back in the day. But Africa Inland Mission, which has been really busy in Kenya especially, I think they had an influence in Sudan as well at one point. And they're still working there. But yeah, the primary denominations that we work with are the Episcopal Church of Sudan and then also the Sudanese Pentecostal Church, which is much newer. Nathan. Right, yeah. It's me. Actually, I think since I left, they did bring in another guy who's going to be doing some water and sanitation work. So I think there'll be three Americans when I get back. That's fine. That's another question. It's a bit tricky. Sort of my understanding is that for a lot of them, it was more, yeah, it was kind of handed to them. But also, it's sort of a way that they differentiate themselves from their northern enemies, because the north is Islamic, and therefore they don't want to have anything to do with that, and so being a Christian is sort of the way to separate yourself from that. They sort of their understanding of Christianity is still really, I often feel like it's quite basic. And you know, one of the things that's been talked about some is working on doing more of like a pastor training program of some sort, which I'm not quite sure where that's at right now with our country office, but I think that is something that could be very, very beneficial, just in sort of developing their sense there for what it means to be a Christian, what all that means. Yes, Sam. Sorry? Yeah, currently the community center is running a school. That's another issue. The community center that we're sponsoring is an English speaking school. A number of the other schools in the area are Arabic, and so it's a lot of people want their children to learn English. A lot of people there in Kurmuk, and some of that I think is probably just because they think English is an important thing for them to learn. But I think often it can also be sort of a reaction to, again, the Arabic North, which I don't think is positive at all. Because, like it or not, you know, they will be tied to the North somehow. and Arabic comes with being a northerner. I don't know. There's a lot of kind of strange dynamics there. Caleb. It varies. Like in Kurmuk, I would say, I don't know what the split is, but I mean, there's definitely a Ministry of Education, and they provide the Arabic speaking teachers, and they've said that they will provide the English speaking teachers. It's just that so far it hasn't quite happened. But I don't really know what the split is between like government sponsored and NGO sponsored. Yes. Yeah. So that's a good question. My title is program manager. I'm basically I oversee the programs that are going on. We have an administrator at the hospital. We have an administrator at the community center. We have an agriculturalist and a veterinarian that takes care of the farm. But I'm then sort of responsible to make sure that those things keep running like they're supposed to. I communicate a lot with Nairobi, turning in reports, writing proposals, just generally, you know, putting out the fires that happen. Nairobi? Oh, flight time, it would be roughly 4 hours. It usually takes us about 2 hours to fly out of Sudan down to Lokichogia, which is just inside of Kenya. And then from there, it's another 2 hours or so. It's basically a model farm. We grow crops there. We have a number, a herd of goats. I think it's right around 250 right now. The idea is to, you know, raise crops, sort of show people proper farming techniques, and it's also a way to generate some income that we can, you know, sell things at the market then and sort of help fund ourselves. The big problem again though is that it happens to be located in a place that's quite inaccessible during the rainy seasons, which is, you know, a good 6 months out of the year, and so it's hard to get anything very productive done. So we're trying to figure out where to go with that right now, actually. Well, if that's all, I just want to thank you again for coming. Sorry that I've gone so far over. I just want to say again, I really do appreciate your interest in my life, both over there and just in general, and for all the encouragement and support you've been to me over the years. It's meant a lot to me. And I think that's all I have, so I'll turn the time back over to Dad.
I thought some of you would find it interesting, the DC-3 that he showed, the first airplane he showed. About a year ago when Angela was getting ready to go to Sudan, we of course looked for every connection we could make. And Glenn Mast, who grew up in Oklahoma, has worked now for JARS for probably 30 or 40 years, found out about Angela going to Sudan. He said, well, he'll probably fly in that DC-3 that we retrofitted for Samaritan's Purse. So two Midwest boys that sort of teamed up. I mean, at least Angela enjoys using that plane. He doesn't enjoy it, actually, not that one. I've always, as a child, I dreamed of being a bush pilot myself until my mother helped me out of that dilemma. And so it is a little gratifying to have a son that gets to use the aircraft even if he doesn't fly it himself. Angela, you said your ride back to the farm has to be on a tractor in the rainy season. Is that right?
Yeah, generally.
And so how long does that trip take?
About an hour, a little over an hour.
20 miles, is that right?
Yeah.
You got to... You must have these sped up little tractors or something. Yeah, that's great. I never asked that question before. Yeah. Thanks so much for your interest. And we do want to thank you for your prayers and continue to trust the Lord for the future. And thanks to you, Angela and Anna, for taking the time here this afternoon. I'd like to ask Perry Miller, would you like to lead us in a word of prayer as we stand and
to be a good testimony for you, whatever you do.